This episode, I'm joined by Alex Monk to discuss his book, Trauma and the Supernatural in Psychotherapy, Working with the Cursed Position in Clinical Practice, alongside discussions on Jung and the occult. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Alex Monk, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We are going to be discussing your book, Trauma and the Supernatural in Psychotherapy, Working with the Curse Position in Clinical Practice, which was published 2023 by Routledge. And as people might imagine, this is a book about the sort of rarely discussed, especially within the modern world, which is unsurprising, the rarely discussed overlap between how we approach notions such as supernatural notions, such as being cursed, perhaps a sort of supernatural paranoia, one's, I guess, therapeutic relationship with God, and even maybe the possibility of like angels and demons, how we approach this within a clinical therapeutic setting, and where these lines are drawn. There's much more to it than that. It was a fascinating book where I had many of my own sympathies sort of addressed there. And just tell us a little bit about yourself and what's the genesis of this text?
Yes, so I'm a psychotherapist, and I work in private practice in London, and after some time of working with clients, I started to notice a particular kind of misfortune that was being presented, or a relationship with misfortune. So people who felt that they were particularly unlucky, that they had this kind of pursuant, internal object, as they might say in psychoanalysis, or something which is daimonic, if as Freud says, which is kind of pursuing them, and that they can't get away from, but couldn't really account for why, and so felt haunted by it. So there's a suggestion of, so at that time there's a suggestion of something that, you know, by the very nature of the word haunting, you know, there is some suggestion of a supernatural agent, and sort of I got the sense that there was something outside of the self that was stalking the person in a way, and then I came across this essay. I was reading a lot of Mark Fisher at the time, so it's going back a bit. And there's an essay of his called Ghosts of My Life, and he talks about this very particular kind of haunting that I'm describing here, and in relation to Japan's song Ghosts, and he talks about how this song echoes through a couple of other artists. That, you know, there's a jungle track which is called Ghosts of My Life. Tricky also samples or gets, I can't remember his name, but the guy from Bristol, I should know, from the pop group anyway, to actually sing particular words from this song. And so there is this sense of, and I think in the song there is this line where Sylvian's saying, you know, just when I'm winning, you know, everything falls to pieces, to paraphrase. And what Fisher says, I think the most important line of what Fisher's saying is that the ghosts return because he fears they will. Okay, so there is this sense that it's our fear, which is kind of bringing on this misfortune. You know, so if only I didn't hit, or I or the subject didn't have this fear, then I'd be okay. So there's this sense of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And Fisher, I think, is obviously very much influenced by Freud. And so he's kind of, there is, implicit in this essay is the uncanny as well, which I imagine we'll go on to talk about. So I won't go say too much about the uncanny at this stage, but there is that in the background. You know, there is this kind of repetition. There's something which is haunting, and that it keeps coming back. So from there, then I just wondered about more though about this supernatural aspect to it that went beyond the material, you know, and what is this kind of fear aspect? How can we think about or explain this feeling that there is this agent, you know, that's outside the self that is causing this misery essentially to people, that is really ruining, sabotaging people's lives? And then I was reading Ronald Hutton's The Witch, which is a great book, and he talks about how there is a sense of, you know, there is a universality to this experience of a fear of the supernatural. You know, no matter how much you know positivistic or materialistic you are, you know, if somebody tells you I've cursed you, you know, that's chilling for anybody to have that, and they'd rather that not be said to them. So there is something perhaps implicit, there's something ancestral here as well that happens outside of the self. Yeah. So that's it in essence. I mean, I can flesh that out more as we go along.
I mean, there's so much there. But I did sort of I found it humorous that you said, you know, someone haunted by an idea, by something that is outside themselves, and this statement of, if only I wasn't haunted by X, then you know it follows. And this is, I mean, I think as a singular statement, that's almost the I dare say foundation. A bit too structural, but I'll use it. The foundation of counseling and maybe therapy, you know, this from the side of the analyst land, or yes, you know, the person who has the problem, is this almost algorithm of, yeah, you know, okay, can you just get rid of X and then I'll be fine, which I think is probably, you know, I mean, is one of the first things to be overcome. But there seems to be, firstly, here then a notion, a problem of control, and I think for me the central question that your book tackled, which maybe I'm misreading it, but it was just, for me it was the central question that it tackled, was this problem of control and a certain contemporary understanding of being haunted, of the supernatural, of things outside of ourselves, of a sort of a focus which is all about ourselves. So it's all about, well, if only it would change towards me. And so I guess, you know, I'm going way too far there. Let's just begin with how you define the supernatural. And I guess also a personal question. Are you a believer in any sort of spiritual sphere? Because your book is constantly dipping into this notion of, well, what do we do with this possibility of another space? And you also use the word daemon, which is, you know.
So in the supernatural, I mean, this is a really difficult word to define, but I'm defining the supernatural as, again, so I suppose I've described it in a way, one way, that there is some kind of agent with its own ontology or with its own agency outside of the self that cannot be explained through material explanation or means, right, or epistemology or whatever you want to say. That's how I see it. And in under that umbrella, I'm thinking about the uncanny as well. So that people might disagree with that, you know, especially if you're a psychoanalyst, is uncanny experience supernatural? Perhaps not, right?
Could you just expand on how the uncanny, just so we've got that as a
the uncanny, so there is the sense of the uncanny. I mean, I couldn't give you the Freudian definition exactly perhaps, but essentially there is this sense of something, like I was saying earlier, which is cracking through, you know, which is coming, there's a crack in one subjectivity, which causes a rupture in one's experience, and uncanny experience, I suppose, can be described as something weird happening, something which jars, and something which is a cross between. I mean, Freud talks about the Heimlich and the unheimlich. Mm. So the Heimlich being the homely or the familiar, the unheimlich, the unhomely or the unfamiliar. And what I'm saying in the book is there is this sense of, well, I don't say it, Freud says it first, but this sense of these being, they're not antonyms, they're kind of false opposites. So there is something misleading about them, right? So experience which comes across as being homely, mm. And cozy and safe, as in the home, mm. right, isn't necessarily so in cases of relational trauma, which I'm talking about in the book. So this is where I'm taking it slightly away from Freud, because I begin talking about trauma. So the what appears to be cozy is actually perhaps about neglect, mm. or abuse, right? And that becomes libidinized. The Heimlich becomes libidinized by the unheimlich in a way. Yeah. So Freud is saying that there's something coming from the past, right? But the difference between my perspective on the uncanny and Freud's is that Freud is saying this is about the return of the repressed, mm. right? So he's saying that this is an old sort of animistic consciousness, a sort of a previous or a more rudimentary state of mental functioning. And it's a sort of an echo of that which is coming back, and that's what makes it weird and strange, mm. and unsettling, right? Because we have progressed beyond that to this stage where we are now, right, through these stages, as Freud and Fraser talks about in The Golden Bough as well, right? So, but what I'm saying is actually, which perhaps you might consider more Jungian in a way, which is that this archaic self or this archaic animistic way of relating to the world, by virtue of repressing that, it's coming back and haunting us, and we need to pay more attention mm. to it and incorporate it more into our subjectivity.
So the problem is familiarity, because your own focus is that it has, you know, you use the word agency there, and there's the notion of a curse, the notion of something outside ourselves. I think from the Freudian, you know, the classically Freudian perspective there, it's still tethered to ourself in the sense that it's, you know, our unconscious, you could say. And there is almost the control is still on our side. But there's a certain increase, possibly, in the fear, in the uncertainty regarding one's unfamiliarity with things, to begin to understand that there might be something outside of yourself that is affecting you, that actually does have its own, completely own agenda, that mm. Isn't tethered to your own control or thought processes. And I think this is where your book sort of soars, is really beginning to outline this as a possibility, unless I'm misreading it.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, I think what happened with the book is that I started with this Fisher perspective, and then I had read Freud's Uncanny before, but not in the same way as, mm. you know, Fisher's work really enabled me to understand the uncanny, you know, on a deeper level. You know, I'd read it in quite a superficial way before, I think. Mm. So, but then as I was writing the book, there was something, I really felt that there's something missing here. You know, this just isn't enough. I felt like I was kind of reinventing the wheel in a way. And because it doesn't account for what you've just been saying, you know, that there is this magical, which I'm referring to as magical consciousness in the book, which is that this actual experience with or interaction with entities that are perceived to be outside of the self, not only inside. And I think, so when you ask me also about my own beliefs, I think, yes, I do believe that that's possible. I do hold that possibility entirely open. And, you know, so I think, I guess the struggle with this is, how does one, and this is another thing with the book, you know, whether these things can ever be united, you know, whether a psychoanalytic epistemology can be united with an esoteric one, you know, or occult epistemology. That's something which perhaps we can explore more. But yeah, and from that, because I think by just leaving it, if you like, with the Fischer and the Freud and the Jung too, because Jung is a whole other thing which we'll talk about, won't we, probably. But leaving it there, there is a real danger of, with people who have developmental or relational trauma, there seems to be, in some cases, an existing relationship with the supernatural and a belief in supernatural forces that can easily become reduced to psychotic phenomena. Okay. So somebody could be re-pathologized or re-traumatized or have one's experience told, you know, what is called in psychoanalysis is pathological accommodation, where they have to accommodate something which isn't their subjectivity, right? So this is really difficult, because how do you know when something is psychotic? You know, this is the age old question with psychotherapy, you know, psychotic and when it's actually numinous or experience of the sacred, which is helpful to a person, or, you know, it, which is not pathological and is not dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, to then pathologize these things is also, you know, is I can't remember what the word is, where the suggestion from the therapist bolsters belief or disbelief or understanding in a certain direction. So, I can't remember the term, but this notion of, if a therapist mentions something, then the actual disorder itself can begin to develop because of that suggestion. And so, but, you know, I mean, just to step back to what you were saying regarding how to synthesize psychoanalysis, or even just modern psychology as well, is even more, has got even less leeway to deal with these things, is if you think of the majority of the world really has some form of spiritual belief. But if we were to take the most common one in the Western world, Christianity, I mean, a large mass of denominations within Christianity do take the devil and demons as literal beings. And so I think within the modern secular world, to then approach that and say, you know, if you go to any psychologist or psychoanalyst and say, you know, the devil is affecting my life quite literally, I mean, that would be very quickly pathologized as perhaps some form of schizophrenia or something along these lines. And so, but equally, there's this problem of to reduce someone's belief within, to take it from one framework just into another framework, is to completely alter it, right? Do you feel you have, I mean, this is a big question, do you feel you've made headway towards some answers as to what is a productive way to approach this problem of synthesis?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the most important thing is from a clinical perspective is to, I mean, I think solving the whole problem of this, I'll maybe stick with just the clinical side of things for the moment, because I might struggle otherwise, but it's already difficult enough clinically. I mean, I think within a private practice setting, such as what I'm working in, that you know, this could get quite tricky, if you know, because if you're going to be working with this, with somebody who is presenting with psychotic symptoms and they seem to be vulnerable, then obviously they should be treated in the correct way, which would be in secondary care. But in terms of actually, in answer to your question, I think you need to meet the person exactly where they are, and to not impose any particular theories or onto the person. So obviously not reducing or something to trauma immediately, or to fantasy, to simply listen to what the person's telling you, and to try to make sense of it with the person. I think if one really helpful thing is if a person has a belief as you, in a demon or a devil, which is outside the self, is to not discount that, to actually, or to reduce it in any way, just to go with that and ask the person more about it. But also to think about how that can also be represented. You know, is there also an internal experience of a devil? You know, is there any experience that you have which can be symbolically represented as a devil? Mm. And I'm conscious, though, as I'm saying this, that there, you know, that can come across already as a potential, like, sort of de facto way of reducing the belief in the devil to a psychoanalytic perspective. Do you see what I mean? But I think I don't see any harm in being open to both of those approaches. And I think if you're going to go through a period, psychotherapeutic treatment, I think you would need to be open to that. I don't see a way around that.
No.
To be open, and obviously, if you disagree with what a therapist is saying and say, look, I don't want to symbolize this, my devil. I'm not going with this. You know, can explore, you know, why that is the case. What is it that's so troubling about the idea of representing that as a, you know, of that being part of your experience? You know, have you encountered devils in your life? You know, So yeah, it is very, very tricky, though. You know, there's no getting away from that.
Well, we spoke about this very briefly in the email exchange. A word that I mentioned that you said puts it well, especially with regard to Jung, because you mentioned symbols there, and it's where I falter with Jung in a way. It's like,
I know, I listened to your Peter Kingsley one recently. It was very good. Go on.
It's fine. I mean, but I think there's almost a progression in psychoanalysis. You know, also did the episode with Gottfried Hoyer about.
Yeah.
So there's progression sort of from this patriarchal, paternalistic Freud, very authoritative, classical psychoanalysis telling you what to do, and it moved through to someone such as Jung. I don't, you know, necessarily see it as maybe a strict linear progression, but Jung has a sort of openness, but he still falters at the end with the word that I used, which is domestication. It's also the word that Kingsley uses.
Yeah, it's fine.
Domestication. And symbols are a way of domesticating the agency that's outside and still trying to retain control in some way. You know, and to try bring it back in and say, like, we can make all of this, you know, work for ourselves or be within our own bounds. What was it about this notion of domestication that seems to just put it right for you?
I really to put it right for me. How do you mean?
you said it caught onto something that you tried to articulate.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I did really, this really grabbed me, this phrase, because you said it in the email, and then I was, I heard it in another interview with Peter Kingsley. I didn't read it in his book. I'm actually reading, I think it's called Into the Dark Places of Wisdom at the moment. I think I haven't read the Cassafelk, is it? Yeah, a recent one. But anyway, this domestication of the sacred. Yeah, that really grabbed me, because one thing that I was really grappling with when I was writing this book is about Jung and with these kind of experiences and this whole Joseph Campbell thing, and Hillman as well, kind of post-Jungians, I suppose you would say, but very much Jung himself. There feels to be that with this kind of experience, it needs to be pulling down into this mythologizing, you know, it becomes a mythology. It becomes part of this sort of structure of the archetypes of the collective unconscious. And I just have a very strong resistance, intuitive resistance to going the whole hog with this. I mean, Jung was very much my first love when I started getting into psychology at, you know, undergraduate university. But yeah, I do feel that, I think you said that this was a missed opportunity. And I do think that there is room for other epistemologies, certainly outside of Jung, and that we can welcome. And again, you know, I think we can think about how that can be done, and there is this split, and again, I talk a lot about this in the book, between psychotherapy and esotericism. You know, psychotherapy, although it's not scientific at all, it's kind of like somehow there is this sense that it is, you know, and this is sort of, there's echoes and reverberations of this from the, you know, when it all started. But that's kind of still there, you know, the kind of the occult is woo-woo and psychotherapy is not, you know. And I think there's a lot of kind of crossover here. And that split doesn't need to be there. And so that's why I talk in the book about, you know, Dion Fortune's work as being helpful, and Austin Osman Spare, for example, that, you know, that they can offer new ways of thinking about experience that can be incorporated with psychology. You know, I don't want to split myself and say, oh yes, idealize the occult or esotericism, you know. Yeah, so mm-hmm. so but I can't exactly, it's hard for me to explain what my problem is with that Jung thing though. You know,
I think you did, maybe this would be my own appreciation, but you did sort of put your finger on it, and it's I see a contradiction in Jung, because as you said, you know, here are the archetypes which are defined, you know, you have them, we can say you're falling into this archetypal thing,
exactly,
which is very, very strict, but equally Jung at the same time is trying to articulate that this is the collective unconscious mythological sphere that has its own thing going on, but at the same time we can absolutely sort of know it say, like, you know, this is this archetype or whatever it might be. I'm simplifying there, but the contradiction seems to be that at one and the same time you're trying to state that there is a place of uncontrol, but also we can, in defining it, have some element of control. And yeah, I mean, there almost seems to be a sort of insecurity in the bridge between them, and an inability to just accept that there are those things out there, whatever that might mean, that are doing their own thing. That I think the most important thing isn't necessarily that they have their own agenda; it's that they are just not in relation to you. It almost seems to be a sort of structural psychoanalytical narcissism, like everything has to come back, but to really accept, well, maybe that daemon or maybe whatever that thing is, it's just doing its own thing, you know, and it isn't anything to do with you. That's kind of tough to accept.
It is hard, because obviously we're relational beings and we want to form relationships, right? As part of our, that's what our subjectivity is based on. So the idea of having this alien other that we can't form that kind of relationship with is disturbing. I think coming back to the Jungian or the archetypal thing, and I'm aware I can feel the Jungians yelling at the moment, but you know that I'm saying this, but because I think maybe there is a danger of simplifying what Jung is saying here, these archetypes, into, you know, it's the juggler and it's the wizard, you know, that kind of thing. But there is a danger with the archetypal system where I think it can be taken in that way. So if somebody's talking about a very, very particular phenomenology, right? Then that's like, oh yes, that's the wise old man that, you know, do you see what I mean? That way it's like, hang on a minute. It's not. It's actually something which is very personal and is not the wise old man. It's something quite different. Sorry.
No. Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I mean, all I was going to say is, you know, this problem I've said, on the one hand, people trying to say like, no, it's not as simple as that is, you know, that's the wise old man, that's the juggler, whatever it might be. But on the other hand, to be able to talk about it at all, there has had to have been these definitions that we've come up with. So there is still some mode of, I think, and I'm always, and I think probably why we're both struggling here is I don't want to do, you know, Jung a disservice, because it's clear from his writings that this is a conversation that he is also equally constantly struggling with.
Yes.
I mean, you know, beneath Philemon, for instance, is always the question of, you know, what exactly is this? Who am I to really even discuss the life of this being, whatever it might be? Yeah. So, but I mean, if we could just turn, I mean, and look at, we sort of discussed the supernatural and this other agency. Mm-hmm. I just want to move, I guess, to bring it back to the clinical and the other aspect mm-hmm. of your book.
Mm-hmm.
Curses, curse positions. I mean, what role and what are curses for you here?
Yeah. So it comes back to this misfortune mm-hmm. again. So the curse is obviously about that happening to the person, and the curse position relates very much to a combination of developmental trauma and what is called in psychoanalysis is unconscious fantasy, and what I add to, which is this, an archaic unconscious. Okay, so there's three aspects which are working together. And the thing is with developmental trauma is that it, until it's healed as much as it can be, it keeps returning. So this relates to what Freud calls this repetition compulsion. In Freudian terms, the repetition compulsion is related to the death drive. So it's about that. So it's about wanting to, it's an aggressive drive, a desire to destroy oneself. And there is something of that nature with the curse position, but the curse position, as it's related to trauma, it's about an identification with an other. So a parent who has neglected, as I said earlier, who has neglected or has damaged, not necessarily through intentionally, but the subjectivity of the child. So the repetition compulsion works by continually seeking out experiences which will heal, if you like, or break the spell of the curse. But of course, with the repetition compulsion, the opposite happens. So somebody, for example, who wants to be loved, and wants to be seen, will keep out seeking a narcissistic other who rejects them and treats them badly in the same way as they were originally neglected. And the curse position is that, as I said earlier, is related to this sense of, instead of experiencing that as an inside, in sense of one's own subjectivity, or as relating it to the developmental experience, it's as if I'm being, either there is somebody out there who wishes to harm me, so it could be another person who is actually causing me harm. You know, maybe they're cursing me in a way, their mere presence is causing me bad luck. Right? Or it could be this supernatural agent, as in, you know, a devil or a witch, you know, or an alien. It could be anything that's outside the self that is causing this bad luck and so causing this uncanny experience. So that's it in essence. And so really, I talk, Mark Fisher talks about the, obviously a lot of people know this already, about the weird and the eerie, you know, and these ideas of failures of absence and failures of presence, you know, the weird being about, you know, a person feeling that they don't belong. And I think with relational trauma, the person who's experienced that, who's been neglected, would feel that they don't belong. They always feel a bit weird. They feel like an outsider. And that just keeps playing out throughout their lives. So that's this kind of the weirdness. And then we have this failure of absence and presence through the eerie, which is where the failure of presence is where the defences are not there. And this is what Winnicott talks about when he defines trauma as an impingement, you know, having an experience where our defences are just not there, either as a child or an adult, and then we become traumatised, right? So there is something, you know, there isn't a skin which is thick enough, there isn't a layer to protect us. Whereas a failure of of absence is where we have an impingement, right? So we have somebody who is kind of violating our subjectivity through it, throughout, you know, however that happens.
There's a recent discussion I had with Todd McGowan, who's
Lacanian,
Freud-Lacanian, yeah. But so he mentions, and this is just me paraphrasing, he mentions at the end of Studies in Hysteria by Freud, Freud says something along the lines of, you know, the task of psychoanalysis is to transform, you know, sort of full-blown despairing depression into just everyday misery.
Yeah.
With McGowan then sort of taking that and saying that the best psychoanalysis can do and offer us is just the ability to perceive our problem, not really this contemporary false notion that you're going to go to therapy and then it's like, right, you know, we've ticked the box and your thing is gone and your problem is solved, a very quantified a way of seeing things. And I think it's one of the errors of maybe how counseling is sort of sold to people now, is that you're going to go and things are just going to be erased and you run away all happy and jolly. You know, McGowan sort of says the best thing that could be offered is just for you to be able to see, I'm doing, you know, as you said with the Freud, I'm in my repetition again. Like to be able to just be able to see that is probably as far as we can get.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in Lacanian terms, we were talking about Zizek before we started recording, you know, Zizek would say, enjoy your symptom. Do you think we could also say enjoy your curse?
I think, that's a difficult one. I mean, I'm thinking of I'd have to think about that, but there's something about what you're saying, enjoy your curse. There's this indication of jouissance here, right? And again, that's there in a lot of Fischer's work too. You know, when he talks about music, there's a lot about this sense of, you know, particularly about jungle, for example, you know, things being very stark and depressing and grim and haunting, but something quite enjoyable about that. So I suppose I agree with what Todd McGowan's saying there, you know, because if we can understand and find a way to mourn the lack, as it were, that we don't, you know, that what's missing in us and what's happened to us, and to, again, to symbolize in the best way that we possibly can, to get to know the cursed part of ourselves, you know, quote unquote, then we can perhaps enjoy that. And I think this is where I err more towards the kind of psychoanalytic way of thinking or object relations way of thinking, rather than the Jungian or other more humanistic ways of seeing of psychotherapy. And sometimes, you know, you can have quite interesting discussions about this with people, is that, you know, there is this, perhaps there's, in a way, it's more realistic, this ordinary and unhappiness thing, you know, that's more achievable. So in a way, perhaps, you know, just to kind of find some acceptance, you know, because with psychoanalysis there, you know, with Freud and with Klein, and I don't know so much about Lacan in this way, but there is always, it's all about grieving and mourning, you know, it's about, you know, the shadow of the object, you know, that falls upon the ego, you know, and it's about recognizing that the self, you know, we can never be masters of our own house, as Freud says, right? Mm. We can't control it. It's impossible, right? So I'm completely down with all of that. And I don't, where I'm not down with it, where I disagree with that, I think, I'll just say a bit more. Mm. So and again, I'm mainly simplifying Jung's work because I'm far from an expert on Jung, far from an expert on any of this, but with Jung, like there's talk about the self, the capital S self, and wholeness, and this kind of actualization also, which you get with humanistic psychotherapies. So, you know, you can become whole, you can become healed, and you can transcend your unhappiness. You will be okay. You know, if you can integrate it all, I don't believe those things can be integrated.
Mm.
So that's where I'm more on the psychoanalytic side. However, I think where I probably would disagree with Todd McGowan is that I'm not a materialist. So I think with the uncanny, with synchronicity, with any numinous kind of experiences, then there is an opportunity for an experience, whether, you know, again, you could, that could, I think you're suggesting that could become quite narcissistic in a way, you know, have a narcissistic relationship with this entity that's mine and, you know, and is, well, understood. Do you see what I mean? Like,
No, this is good, because I think the two modes are defined here, and it's actually fairly optimistic. So if you if you remain within the materialist, you know, and Freud, absolutely, as far as as far as my own knowledge, understanding is, he was sort of an absolute out and out atheist, you know, of the most pragmatic.
Yes and no, you know,
he had a couple of little moments with Jung where he said, I don't want to deal with that. The book fell off the shelf and he said, we'll never talk about it again.
I'll just quickly say, you know, that in a book, there's I think it's the second chapter in the book, there's a whole thing about psychoanalysis and Freud and his relationship to the occult. And he did say, you know, at the end of his career, if I'd had more time, you know, if I could live again, I'd certainly be, in obviously paraphrasing here, I'd be very interested in exploring this more.
Mm.
You know, and he was very, you know, and he did believe that telepathy was a thing. He talks about that in his case studies. So he would, but if you asked him, I guess he probably would have said, yes, I am a materialist and I am an atheist.
No. It's fine. I just think this relationship with this other thing, if you bring it into the materialist sphere, it's sort of that understanding that it's within our bounds. And so the relationship is one which is always going to be coming from us, right? It's always it's sort of been developed from our own mind. Once again, it's a factor of the psyche or something of the mind. Whereas this, where you sort of progress and move forward, I think, is if you, and I think Jung is like the strange middle ground. So to go through that, Jung is the middle ground of, you know, is it, does it have its own agency? Like something in the collective unconscious does have its own agency as a symbol and as a myth. But equally at the same time, the collective unconscious is this sort of self, like ongoing self-creation of the mythos from everything, you know, everything within humanity and myth. And then the next step is to say, well, maybe there is a complete detachment. And I think in that detachment, because there's no longer that tether, it's almost like, maybe sound a little bit pretentious, it almost becomes truly relational again. You can say, oh, you're like, you're this other thing now. I actually can, I just have a discussion with you or whatever that thing might be, because it's no longer, I don't know, from ourselves or whatever it might be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And in psychotherapy, there's always this emphasis on intersubjectivity and recognizing the subjectivity of the other. And again, that's probably quite a Lacanian thing, that the old idea is to recognize, you know, to find oneself sounds quite new age. I don't mean it like that. But, you know, to realize oneself to recognize oneself as a subject. You know, so there isn't this tethering. So to recognize this other subjectivity, if you like, this alien subjectivity or the supernatural, which is completely and form a relationship with it in that way. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So in the consulting room, that's what should be happening anyway, you know, on a human level anyway as well. So that's a mirroring of that.
Mm-hmm. So what role does magic play in this? Because this is probably the other key term in your book that we haven't touched upon yet.
Yeah.
Magic. And then there's also the magical unconscious, which is a term you use.
Yeah. So magic is, I was reading again, so this whole thing coming back to, well, this goes back years to when I was training, and I remember like people talking about magical thinking. Oh, that's magical thinking. That's just magical thinking. And I was thinking, what's this magical thinking all about? And it kind of jarred with me. And I didn't. And again, a bit like what I was saying about the archetypes, I just didn't really understand why then, what it was about it. It seemed quite patronizing. And it seemed like someone's experience was being denigrated to this phrase. And of course, magical thinking is, what Freud called the omnipotence of thought, right? So obviously we're conflating our inside experience with the outside, right? So we're attributing our, you know, there is this kind of actual objective reality out there that's actually happening, but we're kind of conflating what's going on intrapsychically with that. There's this sort of, so there is this kind of, again, so that relates to this early narcissistic period, and it goes from magic being the, or animism being the rudimentary consciousness, through to magic, animism, magic, then religion, and then science being the apex of this. I'm sort of really thinking about John Michael Greer here, because he talks about progress a lot, doesn't he? And there's sort of the problems with that. But so this kind of, so there is this narcissism with magical thinking that, as it's spoken about in psychoanalytic circles sometimes, and in psychotherapy generally, right? So you need to sort of find a way to get somebody to kind of get real and understand the world is grey, and you need to mourn that you can't have this, you know, this kind of magical world. It doesn't exist. So they're all sort of going into this sort of almost into a Dawkins kind of area with it, if you're not careful. So that bothered me, that in the way that, again, so coming back to the traumatized individual, the person who has been told all their lives, you know, what are you talking about? What's the point of doing that? Or, you know, this didn't happen to you. It was nothing, you know. And then they're having these really meaningful experiences with what they believe to be supernatural entities. Perhaps they've, you know, started, I don't know, using tarot cards, or I don't know, they've joined a particular group, you know, they found some solace, sanctuary, and in that, and it's helped them. And then, but then that sort of, they go to therapy and that's magical thinking. Do you see what I mean? So I thought it was like, so again, if you speak to people who practice magic, they often will talk about magical thinking in a very positive way, as it's part of their experience, you know, and not in a pejorative way at all. But I think in psychotherapy, it probably needs a separate, you know, two separate terms. That's what I want to say in the book, to kind of define that. So that's why I thought that Greenwood and Goodwin come up with this definition, which I can read out briefly. They say, of magical consciousness, they say, and I quote here, a relational and holistic aspect of the mind in which spiritual entities are experienced as pervading the universe. Magical consciousness, as we are using the term, differs from logical, abstract, and analytical thinking, the more usual focus of cognitive science. But I end of quote, but I would go up, you know, I'd add to that as well, that we would include experiences of the uncanny and the numinous and synchronicity. And I, you know, Hannah Graf, well, to Hannah Graf talks about this kind of noetic or nous, you know, this kind of consciousness. And I think I'm not sure how you pronounce the name, is Algis Uj Davinis, he's a Lithuanian philosopher, talks about this noetic consciousness, which I think can incorporate this kind of, is something similar to what they're speaking about. So, yeah.
I mean, I'm not, maybe we're on the same page here, but just regarding that definition that you read there, I mean, I still can't help but feel that definition has this, to be honest, almost condescending hesitancy. Like, even when it gives a mile, but tries to just rein it in, this notion of speaking of, what was it again? Speaking of gods or spirits as experienced as if they were real. Was that what it, yeah. So
you mean that's implied here, do you think, in experienced as pervading the universe.
As experienced as pervading the universe.
So there is an as if element, is that what you're saying?
I think you know, you mentioned Greer there, and it makes me, one thing I always think of that Greer says is that within contemporary studies, scientific studies, even theology, psychology, despite the fact that quite literally billions of human beings and throughout time, the majority of human beings have had some form of what we would define as spiritual experience, it's only within the last like 100 years where we would we find, for, and this is to paraphrase Greer, we find we would state that any other reason for that other than the fact these people are actually having experience with a god or a spirit or something else. So once again, this notion of as if spirits pervade the universe. I mean, you know, I almost pray for a psychologist just to say, yeah, gods are real. Like, let's go from that standpoint instead of once again trying to rein it into this is how you are experiencing it, which is, I think, is, you know, it's from us outwards as opposed to, once again, it's bringing everything down and inwards, or from us outwards, like, I'm experiencing that as opposed to that thing is already there. Like, just to say, those things are real. Like, no one's got the courage.
Yeah.
But I get from a clinical standpoint, it's you know, it's interesting actually. Just to bring in another controversial figure, I was speaking to someone about why someone asked Dan Lowe, who is a Reichian Wilhelm Reich therapist, someone asked this question came up about why does Jung, even though Jung is often seen as quite you know, woo woo for many people.
Yeah.
Why does Jung get a pass and Reich doesn't? And someone said, well, what Reich did was he could point to the orgone box, right, and say, that's there. So there's always this risk of psychologists not, I think, maybe not wanting to leave the realm of, I mean, it's understandable, the psyche, and actually say, yeah, that thing is there. I mean, that's where you start to get problems.
Yes, so,
sorry to put that on you.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's where you become marginalized and you're called woo woo, whatever. And obviously, that's what happened to Jung. But he managed to, if we use Freudian terms, to sublimate that very well. You
yeah,
know?
For a long time he did. Yeah.
Right. I don't know so much about Reich's work, but yeah, I've heard about this orgone thing becoming, you know, this way too out there and problematic. So yeah, it's something I need to look into more. But I guess with also with this Greenwood and Goodwin citation here, there's something about, you know, there, it sounds also, I suppose, a bit like they're saying, you know, it differs from a logical abstract and analytical thinking. So, but you could say that about any number of things. You could say that about Jungian, again, you could say that about Jungian analytical psychology, you know, where there, you know, there is a real relief, you know, it's very pleasant relief from this kind of positivistic or materialist approach. But it isn't quite enough, you know. But I suppose it comes back to what I'm saying is that why can we not have both, you know? Why can these two worlds not be, why can we not think about our internal experience in the way that object relations do? And that's my everyday work. I think that's extremely useful. I think we need to be able to mourn and grieve our trauma and to understand our own as much as we can, our drives, you know, our aggressive drives and our, you know, our envy and our hate and etc., right, and our lust, whatever. We need to come to terms with what's driving these and what's causing this trauma as much as we possibly can, because, you know, that's what psychoanalysis has taught us, that we can't know everything, right? There's a limit to what we can know because there's an unconscious. But at the same time, why do experiences of the supernatural have to brought down into this ontology? Right. I don't really see what's so threatening about that, unless it's, again, as I was saying earlier, where we do have to be careful is when we're working clinically, when we're talking about somebody being vulnerable, you know, and where we are idealizing experience that can be threatening to oneself or to another, you know, then that's where it does become more complex. So there is, you know, Melanie Klein's work is really important here because, you know, thinking about the way that we idealize something, the shadow side of that is the persecutory, right? So obviously, if you're only idealizing an entity or a being or a god, then there's another side to it that you also need to come to terms with.
Yeah, I mean, there's still the relation there, right?
Exactly.
That's what you're on about with the two sides of this, the logical and then the spiritual or the magical,
yes,
can coexist. But
yes,
just understand it as having a relationship. I mean, people have a relationship with God. It's not, it's a difference between, I guess, a relationship literally with God or a being, and a relationship with a being that is presumed as sort of one's own creation or one's own projection or whatever it might be. And that's a completely different thing. Yeah, is there anything you'd like to add about your book? Your book goes into far more sort of details. We haven't really touched on Fortune, and I think Fortune is an interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to mention Dion Fortune as you know, one, a very early psychoanalyst.
Yes, she was.
Who then sort of sees that, well, this isn't going far enough, and actually is one of the few to then say magic or occultism is what will help more. You know, those early limitations that she saw. But she
taught the interpretation of dreams. You know, she taught psychoanalysis. You know, she held classes, as I understand it, as well. I think Eliza, there's an essay by, I forget her first name, but it's Richardson is the surname. Mm. It's in the book, very excellent essay about Dion Fortune and psychoanalysis. And she was a lay analyst, and she was practicing. And because there was psychoanalysis in its infancy in London, there was a plethora of different modalities that fell under the umbrella of psychoanalysis, such as body psychotherapists and I can't remember all the different modalities, but lots of them. But yeah, with regard to Dion Fortune, there's this whole chapter about psychic attack, because I'm using her book as a reference, Psychic Self-Defense, Dion Fortunes, and thinking about that as in terms of power relations, you know, and the curse. So if you think about Fisher, actually, it's in a weird way, it sort of connects with Fisher, because he writes a lot about class and inequality and coming from a place of always feeling that you're lesser, you know, like you're talking about David Sylvian being this working class boy, talking about Tricky with the same, having the same sort of ghosts. But then this need to to become empowered, again, is the word agency. And I guess this is where knowing oneself can be helpful. And so the way that the supernatural and cursing can become a means of agency, right? And I also speak about, I know we're running out of time now, but speak about M. Okay, so the way that that psychic attack can be a way of, or what is known as, you know, pejoratively as black magic, can be a way of a means of empowerment as well. Right. So where people do feel, and this is what happened particularly with the witchcraft trials as well. Right. What Emma Willoughby's work is talking about is that when we talk about the witchcraft trials, and that there is this idea that the witches never actually practiced black magic. You know, that's not true. That they were told to say that they did. You know, that they weren't really cursing people. That they were kind of these poor innocent victims. But what Emma will be saying is that there is a sense that there is, again, there's this removal of their, there's sort of adjusting of their subjectivity. There's something threatening about these people having power, having agency, that they did have the capacity to use magic and may have relied on that as a means to harm, right? So again, there's this kind of there is this sort of cultural reenactment of trauma as well.
Is there anything you'd like to add about? Sorry, I don't really know what to follow on from that. I mean, all I'm thinking is I know books that are now along the lines. I mean, I think of The Chaos Protocol was by Gordon White. It's actually a book that sort of takes up this stance in relation to Clark, like an overlap really between what you could sort of like a Fisherian understanding of class and how to utilize magic in relation to ongoing economic struggles. It's all very much still, yeah.
Well, I think there's, you know, there's kind of, I think with that chapter about Dion Fortune, and so there's a, you know, there's this idea about projective identification in psychoanalysis and psychic attack. Mm. And it's comparing, that chapter compares two different ways of thinking about this other, which is, you know, this that is attacking from a distance, from a materialist perspective through the psychoanalytic idea of projective identification, and through the occult or esoteric perspective. What I'm saying in that chapter is actually there are some similarities that are not being spoken about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Would you say the book comes to a conclusion? Something, or let me rephrase it.
Yeah.
Something that you would like to see, you know, find its way into clinical understanding.
Yeah, I think, as I say, well, I think it could be, some conclusion with regard to what we've been speaking today. To particularly, I don't think I do come to a conclusion in the book. I think this is very much an initial exploration of this. But I would say is that I think, given probably because of the internet and we're living in such pluralistic and uncertain times, that there's so much scope for conversations outside of psychotherapy, so that, you know, that we, with practitioners of magic, with scholars from anthropology, from history, that maybe we can rethink the way that we think about psychotherapy and our clinical understanding, and perhaps not try to kind of live so much in silos, you know, and not to find a way to not see this as threatening. You know, mm-hmm. not to see this kind of, so not to reenact, because I talk a lot about splitting in the book, you know, that this splitting happened, you know, Judeo-Christianity, you know, with, you know, between good and evil, Zoroastrian splitting with psychoanalysis, not wanting to kind of be part of the occult, you know, and this kind of, and then you have all of these different schools, and, you know, so all the time there's this disowning of a part of the self, which also which is happening culturally, which happens every day on Twitter, where they know this is your stuff, it's not mine, because I'm ideal and I'm amazing and you're just rubbish, you know, all of this that's happening all the time. So I think it's really just, you know, on a very simple level, just encouraging more discourse of a healthy, or not so much of a healthy, because that's more of a value judgment, but perhaps of a more respectful and open way to other people's subjectivities. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts can we find the book?
So usual places, Routledge website, Amazon. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And do get in touch, please, if anyone wants to continue the conversation. I have a website, so yeah.
What are you working on now?
I'm really not. I'm just really just reading. I'm not really working on anything specific, James, because I haven't got a specific idea of anything. But I'm just kind of, I suppose, I'm looking really furthering to continuing this way, rather than looking less so about the psychopathological or traumatic side of experience, but perhaps more looking at the numinous, the uncanny, the transcendent, and so looking more in that area. But where it's going to go, I don't know.
Wow, it's been a fascinating conversation. I'll be sure to put the links for your book and your site in the description below. Alex Monk, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, James. Thank you so much.